Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's one of my good buddies, and he is a fellow freedom fighter. His name is Robert Barnes. Robert, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Glad to be here.
All right, so let's go over some topics that are on the forefront of everyone's mind. First and foremost, what's happening with the FOIA request that we did with the Federal Reserve? If my memory serves me right, that was probably, 6 months ago? Something like
yes.
That? Yes. And so I think we've submitted several requests to them, or one big giant request. And then we were kind of in a holding pattern last time you and I spoke, which was at the mastermind group that I had with Ken McElroy and Jason Hartman. So where are we now? Are we still just waiting to hear back from the bureaucrats?
They are late in responding. So okay. We are at some point, if they don't respond by the end of February, then we may just initiate legal action. Technically, we have to exhaust administrative remedies before bringing a FOIA suit, but they are late. And they have to respond within a certain time period. They asked for an extension in October, which ran out in January. And okay. So we'll see. We may get something this month, or if not, then we'll have to initiate legal action.
And how does that work? Hopefully we won't have to, but what if we have to go down that road? What does that look like?
We just file a suit in federal court and say that, you know, they're out of time.
To avoid by getting the actual... Yeah. Documents that we requested.
Exactly.
Okay. So what do you think? Do we have a specific deadline, or are you going to play it by ear?
We can't sue until the end of the month. That'd be the earliest we could sue because of the time the statute affords them. But my guess is we probably will get a response from them this month. And the question is, how many documents do they produce, or do they try to buy more time?
Right.
But they're running out of time in terms of their statutory responsibilities.
Yeah. In my experience with lawsuits, and I've been in a couple of them, obviously you've been in thousands probably, but so you've got a lot more experience than I do. But whenever you're asking for documents, at least in the lawsuits I've been in, they always wait till the very, very last minute. And then they try to push it even further. They basically wait till they think that you're going to take more legal action, and then you all of a sudden get it really quick.
Exactly.
Then your experience, and I'm not talking about just the Fed. I'm talking about even a lawsuit between private parties.
Oh yeah, no doubt. It's buy time, yeah, and right. Turn it over on the eve of the, well, I'm about to get whacked.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they do that for a couple reasons. A, they want to draw things out as long as possible, so you spend more money. And then B, the longer they can wait to get it to you, the less time that you have to review it. Often in a case, you know, where there's another deadline that the judge is imposing. So if they can get you that, you know, if you're going to court at 6 a.m. the next morning or 9 a.m. or something, and they get the documents to you the night prior at midnight or something, then that's to their benefit because you have less time to review. Does that happen as well sometimes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the worst version of that for me was the Snipes case. In the Snipes case, I got the documents for the witnesses the next day around 9 p.m. the night before. So everything was, you know, crash course till 3 a.m., try to sleep for 2 hours and then get up and roll.
Okay. So let's plan on doing another interview maybe in a month or so that we can reconvene and then give everyone another update on that. Let's move to the truckers. I think that's what everyone's talking about. I'm trying to pay as much attention to that story as I can. Initially, I thought this was probably going back 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I thought it was just a group of truckers that were kind of driving across the country of Canada, protesting, pushing back against these mandates. And then I knew it got bigger and bigger and bigger. What I didn't realize is that they were going to just kind of park in Ottawa and just basically stay there until Trudeau is willing to at least discuss what's happening with the mandates, the medicine mandates, we'll call them, to be YouTube friendly. I didn't, and I think they've been there now for maybe a week or so, for those who aren't following the story, and it doesn't look like they're going anywhere. So I'm sure you've really been on top of this. What's happening, and what do you think will happen in the weeks to come?
Yeah, my friend and business partner, Viva Fry.
Yeah, I've heard he's doing an incredible live stream there.
Yes, he's been on the ground like 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours a day. Travels all the way from Quebec over to Ottawa and just interviews tons of people. And he's doing some of the best on the ground interviewing and old school reporting.
Yeah.
Media used to do that. You know, CBC has not covered it in Canada. In fact, initially CBC was pretending there was no the Canadian version, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Canadian version of CNN or NPR or the BBC or CNBC for the financial folks out there. They're pretending it wasn't happening. And Right. Then once it was happening, they were pretending that it was for some reason other than vaccine mandates. But it just so over the independent media covered it so extensively. And then, you know, the truckers decided to honk a little, and that drove all these Ottawa pro-government, pro-mandate, you know, anti-freedom people. What finally broke them was truckers honking their horns and honking their, doing the old routine.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, like, well, that's too far. I mean, they even went to Canadian court and said, "Judge, please make them stop. Make them stop the honking." Even though as the local trucker said, when one guy was complaining, said the honking will continue until freedom returns, which was paraphrasing what has been said by the governments in all these cases of, you know, the rules will continue until you comply. It was a nice, you know, turn of phrase on that. But yeah, it was a bunch of truckers all across Canada, and it was because of a vaccine mandate that was going to be imposed on them, or medicine mandate, as we can put it, that they decided, you know, we got to take action. We got to stand up for our fellow truckers. They came in from all across Canada. They've been living in their cabs for the most part. And then a whole bunch of people kept joining them as they were coming in, including people who were not truckers. And then as people saw it sort of develop, more people started coming down to Ottawa. They were playing hockey in the streets. They were having, you know, night DJ parties out in the streets. It's safer than it's been in Ottawa in a while. They were helping homeless people. You know, homeless people actually got some help because the truckers were now in town. And Justin Trudeau decided to find out where he could hide out. He suddenly had COVID, even though he's been, you know, triple shot. I thought that wasn't supposed to happen, right, Justin Trudeau?
Yeah.
He said he hadn't tested positive, but it was magical. He had to quarantine right as the truckers showed up in town.
Right.
And then when it kept developing, he said, "Oh, you know what? I actually do have COVID. So I'm going to have to quarantine for like 2 weeks instead of 2 days." Just came out of hiding, I think, yesterday. So it's just been sad and pitiful to watch the reaction. And this is because the Canadian courts have failed. They have failed to enforce their charter of freedoms. But, you know, what happened with the trucker rally is it brought out one of the last living founders of the modern day Canadian Charter of Freedom, because their constitutional liberties are really more modern in the Canadian era than they are in America. And now he's going to bring legal action to try to restore those freedoms against all of these insane mandates and things like fathers were losing children of their custody over their children over not being vaccinated. People were being excluded from grocery stores out of not being vaccinated. I mean, it was insane.
Okay. So I want to get into the law because that's your area of expertise, but just before we do, where can people find the live stream from your partner?
Viva Fry, FREI. So just look up Viva Fry on YouTube, Rumble, Twitter, anywhere. He'll be linking it on Twitter, but he's both on YouTube and Rumble.
Okay, very good. Now let's go back to the Canadian law. So how does this, I guess for starters, let's go over how this would work in the United States, because maybe that's law most of the viewers and listeners are more familiar with. And then let's compare that to Canada and how you think this will play out in Canada.
So, I mean, in the United States, our constitutional liberties are more clearly protected over a longer time period. Our constitutional rights are older than the Charter of Freedom is in Canada. And our courts do a better job, for the most part, of enforcing them. I always tell people, you know, imagine if, you know, California, Illinois, Massachusetts, and New York were the only states. That's what large parts of Canada are like.
All right.
Particularly Ottawa, particularly Quebec, particularly Toronto. Those
we have
areas.
More precedence as well because there's just been more cases.
Yes, definitely. Oh, the United States is so much bigger, so we have more litigation in general. And we have a much more robust, extensive history of constitutional liberties mattering more than state prerogatives or state privileges. Canada, less so. Okay. And now they still have the Charter of Freedoms. And sadly, Canada just hasn't enforced them during this time period. Because the way I've compared it is it's like if your judges were all from Massachusetts or Maine or some of these states where the courts have not enforced the Constitution here even. And that's what most of your Canadian courts are like. And then the politicians in Canada, even though they had an election last year, there was the rise of a small populist party, but the traditional conservative party kept going back and forth. They took a Boris Johnson style position on a lot of these restrictions. So there wasn't the political momentum that there is in the United States fighting these mandates. But I think what the truckers did is the truckers awoke parts of Canada that were asleep. Over a third of Canadians said they strongly sympathized with the truckers' positions, with the truckers' approach. It also reflected the what was happening in Canada is happening in the United States, and that in the United States, we're seeing it reflected in the legal system with the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on the OSHA mandate, with a lot of federal courts enjoining almost every federal mandate that exists, and with a lot of employees bringing EEOC complaints and federal lawsuits over the mandates. And then I'm part of several suits with Children's Health Defense challenging the FDA and how they've handled all of these authorizations and so-called approvals for the vaccines in an unprecedented and illicit manner. But the other problem is the failure. And that was the failure of these mandates to, you know, the whole premise was that Trudeau pitched was the same as what Biden pitched. You know, these mandates will allow us to return to normal. And instead, it kept getting less and less and less normal, and it became more and more clear they meant a new normal, and that new normal isn't very popular anywhere in the world. But what they saw with these truckers is it ignited not only attention from Canadians who had been kind of asleep at the wheel, but it attracted and ignited attention from around the globe. You right. started seeing, you know, trucker convoys in Australia, trucker convoys in Holland, trucker convoys in other parts of Europe. Yeah, people started waking
you,
up.
I was going to ask you about that. Last night specifically, I was reading about one that was, I don't know if it started or they're trying to start it in New Zealand. And so do you think that has legs from what you're hearing? Do you think that's going to, do you think we may see these just sprout up everywhere and maybe some larger than what we've seen in Canada?
Yes, because I think Canada inspired it. What Canada reminded people, even in countries like Australia and New Zealand that have also been kind of crazy during this environment, yeah. is that they can take collective power that can get people's attention, that can get politicians' attention. And it and the intensity of it, like Canada is so unaccustomed to this. So like when the French do this every other year for any reason, right? You know, if you're out, you know, the farmers start dumping stuff on the side on the roads in the country when they're mad. And so they're more accustomed to it. Canadians are shocked by it because they're always so polite and nice and civil. And so when they see truckers still doing it in a very polite, nice and civil way, but making their voices heard and they're pro and willing to lose money week after week after week by being there, even under threat by the local police, even by under threat by the prime minister of their country, it reminded them that they actually do have some core values in Canada and that they've been walking away from those core values now for several years. And for what? Just for it to keep going on and continuing unabated. And I think you're going to see it happen in places like Australia, places like New Zealand. They're talking about it here in the United States, big trucker convoy to DC. So I think that, and what was interesting was the response of the politicians was to regurgitate a lot of the lies about January 6th. Like Trudeau was pretending this was somehow an insurrection. This was somehow domestic terrorism. And it's like, no, it's just truckers who are going to hang out until you chat with them and quit violating their rights and liberties.
Did you follow that story where Trudeau was saying that they were, you know, first and foremost, a fringe minority? And then he was saying, well, they're holding signs that have swastikas. They're most likely racist. They're this, and you know, all these just kind of disparaging terms that pretty much mean nothing in today's day and age because they're used so generally. But one thing, and I'd like to see if you've read stories on this to see if that's true. The other thing that he was saying, or maybe the media was saying, the Toronto Star, is that the truckers were stealing food from the homeless, and they were doing something to statues and whatnot. I remember when I was reading the thing with Trudeau, when he was talking about the Nazi flags or whatever. I think what he was talking to, because I saw a few pictures of this in the media, where they had a flag with Trudeau's picture on it. And then they had a swastika next to that. And the implication there was that Trudeau was in fact behaving as the political party in the 1930s in Germany. And I think Trudeau, and this is just shows the viewers here, how the media can spin these things, and the politicians. He'll take that and say, oh, they've got flags with this Nazi logo on it. When you take it out, when the average person sees that, like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Maybe, even if they're sympathetic to the cause. I've heard Tim Pool talk about this. He says, well, you know, in a large group like that, there's going to be a few people who are kind of crazy. So, you know, we've got to look at the group as a whole. But again, I don't know if it's that or if it's just the media taking things out of context where, you know, that flag was meant to disparage Trudeau, not to say that they believe in an ideology that we saw in Germany in the 1930s. Have you had your finger on the pulse of kind of what that narrative is that Trudeau's talking about and what reality is?
Yeah, it was fascinating watching the narrative shift in live time with the institutional press, both in Canada and to some degree here in the States, which was first that it didn't exist. Then second was it wasn't anything about the mandates. And then third, it was a fringe minority that didn't really matter, that was going to be really small, maybe 20 people or something. Yeah. Then fourth, well, it's a fringe minority that's actually dangerous and scary, because they're insurrectionists. They're like the January 6th people in America. That transitioned into, you know, one Confederate flag, the one swastika imagery connected to Trudeau, as you mentioned. Now, like, take the example of the Confederate flag guy. That guy nobody knew, had a mask, and disappeared when anybody started asking him questions, which was a sign of, it turns out there's been Antifa people trying to infiltrate. There's been some false flag people. There's on video, you know, but for all this being on video, they might have got away with stuff. One guy pretended he was run over by a trucker, and he just went in front of a truck and fell down. Problem was, he was right on camera. They caught him doing it. Whereas people have attacked some of the truckers and things like that. The statute that they said was, you know, scandal. It was fascinating. Suddenly Trudeau cares about statues. When the BLM of Canada was destroying statues, that's just fine. They're taking down symbols of evil. But, you know, if a statue gets dressed up for a day, and that's basically all that happened, then they clean it up and it was cleaner than it was before. Then, you know, suddenly it's a great offense. People got, you know, video of the statue showing there was no damage to it whatsoever. And it was probably the cleanest that statue had been in 30 years. And then the same with it. So all the imagery, all the stories, every narrative kept falling apart in live time. And I think the problem for the media has been, aside from just lying about this subject matter for the last 2 years, the institutional media and the independent media, people like Viva and other people being on the street, and people could see live interviews and see who these people are in live time. Is that they kept shifting their narrative. You know, first it was, this doesn't exist. Then it's just a fringe group. Now it's actually a big dangerous group. And it's like, okay, obviously you're just changing your story to fit a narrative that isn't really accurate. And more people sought out independent media. Like Viva, he had like 400,000 people watching live. Wow. And, you know, just massive viewership of across all platforms. And what is there, like, hold on a second, this isn't what the institutional media told me. These are a bunch of nice, everyday, I mean, and Canadians from all walks of life, Indian tribal member Canadians from immigrant Canadians from overseas, Canadians that were of all racial backgrounds, all religious backgrounds, all across the nation. Anybody who knows truckers knows that's not a big shock. you know, trucking is one of the best working class jobs in the world in the West. And they tend to come from every background known to man, because the only thing that keeps them in common is they're willing to work hard hours and they like being independent. And that's why truckers made great protesters. When I, in a jury trial, I will always pick a trucker. If somebody tells me they're a trucker, I'm putting them on the jury. One of the best jurors in the Snipes case was a trucker. So he told me he was a trucker. I was like, we're in business. And so that's the real reality of what's happening.
Yeah. You know what this whole thing reminds me of, and, or just makes me, I guess, remember the importance of civil disobedience, or the power, maybe that's a better way to say it. It reminds me of the power of civil disobedience. And I know like gun rights are extremely important, but I've heard a lot of people say the only difference between us and Australia with their quarantine camps is the fact that we have a lot of guns. I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I'm an advocate for the Second Amendment. I think that everyone should own and understand how to use a firearm. But I just think about Phoenix in 2020 when they went to the lockdowns. And number one, people didn't, you know, stand up with, and I'm not saying anyone should be violent, but no one stood up with their guns. And if you would have had, let's say, 1,000 or 2,000 people in Phoenix stand up and go out to the streets with their shotguns or whatever it is, you know, I mean, they would have been completely wiped out by the police, the government, the military, XYZ. But if you would add all 4 million people that live in Phoenix with no guns, just go out to the street and continue to walk their dog, continue to open their business, continue to go to the gym, and just say, no, we're not doing your lockdown thing. There's nothing the government could have done in that situation. And another example of that, I just tweeted this out the other day, it's a story that you might find fascinating. We did our last mastermind group, the collective, which you were a part of the very first one, but we did our second one just the other day in Naples, Florida. So all the members had to fly into Fort Myers. And as you know, Naples, Florida is you want to talk about people who are independent and like their freedom. That would be Naples, Florida. So my research assistant, Josh, who you know, he had a connecting flight in Charlotte. So his flight from Charlotte to Fort Myers, he said that about once they got up in the air, kind of moving, about 70% of the people on the plane took off their mask. 70%. And, you know, the flight attendants kind of panic and what do we do? What do we do? And they went to the front and they asked, you know, on the loudspeaker for everyone to put their masks on. And they just politely said, no, we're not, no. And they're like, okay. So they didn't, I guess they didn't serve food or they didn't serve drinks. But they just kept flying and landed in Fort Myers. And like, okay, have a good day. But it just goes to show you the power of civil disobedience. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's often underestimated. The people forget that they hold the power. You know, I always like to say the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people he did not exist. The greatest trick the system ever pulled is convincing people they cannot resist. And that is constantly a recurrent throughout all political history. It's the reason why the government obsesses over taxes, as an example. I remember having this conversation with a attorney general in Maine, and it was about that, you know, my client had unique beliefs about the tax system, didn't think it was being legally imposed. He'd been reading a little Irwin Schiff and some people like that. Yeah. And the prosecutor was like, you don't understand, Mr. Barnes, we have to prosecute your client because if we even get 10% of lobstermen here in Maine to adopt your client's position, this whole system of ours collapses. And I remember telling him, well, if I go to trial and win, I'll guarantee you'll have that 10% in a year. So maybe you should, you know, reconsider how you want to approach it. But it was very revelatory. It's why the system, we're one of the only countries in the world that criminalizes taxes in the modern world. Most countries just, you do civil fines, things like that. Why is the United States federal government so paranoid about taxes? Because they know how our country was founded. All it took was about 10, 20% of people saying, I'm not paying the tea tariff. I'm not paying this. I'm not paying that. I'm not paying the tobacco tax. Like Patrick Henry made himself famous, arguing for the lowest possible fine in that case, which the jury gave him. What the system knows that it only requires a few neos in the system for the system to collapse if it just gets enough popular support. So like if there's only one or two of us not wanting to do our mask on a plane, the plane will probably be willing to stop and sanction us and remove us and whatever. But if it's the most of the plane or even 20% of the plane, they're just going to give up and go to the front and say, screw it. Yeah, right. And so that's the reality across the board. If people had mass civil disobedience, mass noncompliance, I mean, it's how Martin Luther King built the civil rights movement. Just walk into a Woolworths and sit there. And it wasn't by, Rosa Parks. I'm going to sit in the front today. And what happens, you find out the system's not, it relies upon only 1 or 2% resisting. It's why they thought these mandates would work. Historically in the school systems, only 1 to 2% of parents were saying no to the massive number of vaccines their kids were being ordered to take. I mean, even when those went from like 3 or 4 vaccines to 8 or 9 to in some states, there's like 60 vaccines on this kid's schedule. It's like, how exactly did we suddenly need 60 vaccines? And that's what got Bobby Kennedy involved in these issues. But but it's only been about 2-3% complaining. And that's what they thought in the employment context. They're like, only 2-3% employees lose. No biggie. What happens when it's 5%, 10%, 20%? System tumbles. System cannot handle it. And so, there's been a range of data studies in a wide range of contexts that 20% threshold is like a magical threshold. And it's like in neighborhoods. If a neighborhood hits 20% A, B, C, or D, all of a sudden the neighborhood will flip within a year in terms of who lives in the neighborhood. A whole bunch of those examples. It's just something about that. Once you get to that threshold, the system collapses. Almost
it's like a
every
bank run. It's like a bank run with fractional reserve banking, isn't it?
Exactly. All you need is just enough people. You don't even need a majority. And really it's 2-3% leading the rest and getting 10-20%. And that's where, like in Canada, Trudeau had to panic because they were getting a third of the people in Canada were suddenly like, we agree with the truckers. All of a sudden overnight, several big provinces decided, you know what? We don't need those mandates anymore. Well, yeah, we can take them away.
That. I think Saskatchewan came out, I think, or is Alberta. I'm sorry.
Both of them did.
Yeah, I know. Well, Alberta is the province. Like, and Saskatchewan is a province as well, isn't it?
Yes. I can't pronunciate Sasquatch. I always get, I see a Sasquatch and I can't get the name right.
Saskatchewan, yeah. And I know, yeah, so Calgary is in Alberta. I know I've actually been to Calgary, but Alberta is the province. Yeah, I know that the Alberta gentleman, I think just last night or the night prior, said he was going to pull back on the restrictions. And I think they did it in other places as well.
Yes. I mean, and Quebec was going to tax the unvaccinated. Right. I mean, which is just some of the, you can see the government's going through their wish list of power, and like, oh yeah, we'll try this. We'll try this. We'll try this. He reversed as soon as the trucker convoy took off. All of a sudden the Quebec premier, who has loved all the lockdowns and all every other restriction, keeps imposing curfews on Quebec every other week. Always 2 weeks to flatten the curve becomes 6 months, which was, the truckers were great at this stuff. They're like, how long are you going to be here? 2 weeks to flatten the mandates. They were playing off all the politician language over the last year that was just exposing the politicians for the fraud that they are. And it was done in such a genius way. I mean, it goes back to like guys like Abby Hoffman, who actually convinced some people in the Pentagon that they were really going to levitate the Pentagon. So he said, let's all protest. We'll say some magic language and we'll make the Pentagon lift above the ground. And the security people went nuts about it. It's like, I mean, obviously it was comedic public gesture, but it was genius use of it politically. The truckers have employed every effective tool in that respect while making sure it stayed civil, making sure it never turned violent, making sure nobody was a problem, cleaning up its own if anybody was trying to act out. And it's just exposed the system as we would be better off being governed by any of those truckers down there in the center of the square than the politicians we have.
Absolutely.
And that revelation to more and more people led to the mass resistance we now see. And we're seeing changes even when Quebec is like, okay, we're not going to tax the unvaccinated anymore. Okay, maybe I'll stop the curfew. That shows how effective these truckers have been.
So where do you think we are with Canada and the United States in 3 months, 6 months?
I think you're seeing, you know, Richard Barris, the People's Pundit, and I predicted last year that the big mistake Democrats were making in the states and many of the Western governments were making was they really convinced themselves that all of these things would be popular over time. And our position was, if you really understood the data, like if you dug into the data and asked the question the right way, you found 2/3 of Americans, up to 80%, depending on the question, opposed any adverse consequence for not getting a drug. So the mandates were not popular as to schools, not popular as to travel, not popular, definitely not popular as to taking away somebody's job. And instead, they were asking the mainstream media were asking public opinion questions in sort of couched manners that said, well, if you could return to normal, do you think it would be okay to mandate this? You could get majority support for that. But that wasn't, if you asked the real question, you found out, no, this was not popular at all. There's about 20-25% of the country that were, you had enough Karens, that's all you could get to. Karens are not a majority. And so you're starting to see it, like Ted Lieu, you know, that kind of loony congressman from California, he's now discovered natural immunity. I mean, he actually tweeted out that, well, you know, when you think about it, I mean, people have been screaming that for a year, and now you finally discover it. They're finally discovering, like, they're now finally, the Biden administration now is asking hospitals, by the way, how many people are actually in the hospital from COVID rather than with COVID?
Yeah, Fauci even said that about kids about a month.
Exactly. And where it's going is this: they're trying to find an exit path. Biden is the most hated president, maybe ever, to some degree. I mean, when you really, given how polls are inflate in favor of Democrats, his real approval rating is probably like Nixon 1974, George W. Bush late 2008, in the 30s, low 30s would be my guess. The Democrats are looking at a complete wipeout in 2022, and they had convinced themselves that doing these policies would not only be popular, but that somehow it would bring back the economy and they could continue to do their MMT style, just spend, just put money out, put money out, put money out. They can't get anything through the Senate, so the legislative agenda is dead. And the economy is doing the worst combination that you've been talking about for the last year, which is what happens with the way they were doing things. You could recreate the stagflation of the 70s, where you have economic stagnation while having inflation. If you look at, you know, shadow stats, our inflation right now is as bad as it was in the late 70s if we were using the same metrics. So all of that, and people are seeing it every day. Richard Barris polls people and it's off the chart agitation levels on inflation issues. And it's because it's everyday issues. It's milk, it's eggs, it's meat, it's basics that are all of a sudden, that's like, that's just double. How did that double within the last 6 months? Things like that. Oh, they can see it at the gas prices, which is one of the most everyday common expense that people have. And historically, nothing destabilizes a government like inflation does. Right. So you combine all the economic failures that weren't supposed to happen, that Democrats are slowly starting to realize lockdown politics creates inflation stagnation problems that you might not be able to get out of without sinking the stock market, because you, Fed, maybe go ahead and raise those interest rates. Oh, well, hold on a second. You know, I mean, they're in a lot of catch-22s because of their policies over the years.
And what that means to them, which they're most concerned with, is the probability of them being reelected is a lot lower now than it was, call it, 6 months ago.
Democrats have faced the biggest deficit in what they call the generic ballot, the House congressional ballot, that they have ever faced in polling history right now. So what, yeah, you're talking about just getting crushed, losing the House, losing the Senate, losing the governorships of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, losing them again in Florida and Georgia and Arizona. And not only that, a whole bunch more populists getting elected, which is what this, you know, Bill Gates of the world never wanted. You know, your J.D. Vance's in Ohio, your Blake Masters in Arizona, your Eric Greitens in Missouri, your Adam Laxalt in Nevada to the U.S. Senate. I mean, these are people that I've regularly talked to, and that gives a sense for it, right? The Mitch McConnells of the world aren't reaching out to the populist wing here. These guys do on a routine and regular basis. And what happens when they have power? All of a sudden, you know, Rand Paul is not by himself anymore in the United States Senate. And Josh Hawley's not by himself anymore on his issues in the United States Senate. And then a whole bunch, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is the most popular congresswoman on the in the Republican Party. She's also one of the most populist. Matt Gaetz, same dynamic. Madison Cawthorn, same dynamic. So all of a sudden, it's not just that they're going to get wiped out in the House, wiped out in the Senate, wiped out at the state level, but it's going to be a bunch more populists that think Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates need to be under criminal investigation. And GoFundMe, as an example, a bunch of these guys supported a criminal investigation of GoFundMe when they tried to steal the trucker convoy money, which, you know, they reversed course in about 12 hours. But it gave you a sense of, you know, big tech's used to being immune. A lot of big actors are used to being immune. They all face comeuppance. And so I think what we're going to see over the next 3 to 6 months is a lot of Democratic politicians try to figure out where's the exit ramp for this. And what they'll probably do is they do what they do on the economic side. They're going to change how they measure the data to say they've actually succeeded. Because what they'll do is they'll finally identify that a lot of the people going into hospitals are with COVID, but they'll say, look at how many people we've cured. The hospitalization rate is dramatically dropped in half. You know, our strategy worked. That's going to be the pitch.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
You know, what I was thinking about, Robert, first of all, I wrote this down. I wanted to comment along the lines of what you're referring to. You know, with the Rebel Capitals channel, I do news stories every day. So I've really got my finger on the pulse of news more so than I usually do with just the whiteboard videos. And I know the gal that, what's the gal's name that does the announcements for the Biden administration?
Jen Psaki.
There you go. She came out and she said that the Biden administration has always been opposed to lockdowns, opposed to lockdowns. And she said, no, we weren't the ones that did the lockdowns. That was the Trump administration. We've always been opposed to them. So I thought that was okay. You could kind of see what you're saying, that you know now that this is very politically unpalatable for the voters. And, you know, going back probably, even when we first came out with Omicron, I noticed the media, well, after that first 2 week period or so, I noticed them really starting to do a 180. Sure, they're talking about, you know, surveys of sickness, you know, doom, 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 doom. But I saw them starting to do some articles on how, well, maybe, you know, what you're talking about, maybe people were going to the hospital with and not as a result, or maybe we should look at comorbidities. You saw the CDC come out with that study the other day that actually said that natural immunity was superior. And I watched a video with our good friend, Dr. Chris Martinson, and he went through those data. And I mean, that was staggering. I don't see how anyone can look at that and look at the media, what they've had to say over the last 6 months, and trust them as far as they can throw them. And I think that, to your point, this is definitely going to continue. Because the Democrats know that's the only way that they have a prayer of being reelected. So you think we're going to see like a red wave, so to speak, And therefore, like if I were to say, you know, I know you like to play some bets every once in a while. If you had to place a bet on, you know, fast forward in the United States in 6 months, what cervasa sickness, we'll call it restrictions, do you think we will have? And what, which ones do you think we will no longer have?
I think we may, I think all of them may be gone. I think the mask mandates are
even
probably
like New York and LA and whatnot.
Yes. California just announced it's finally going to lift its mask mandate. You know, and this all, and it, what's amazing is how much of this, what the truckers did is they drew attention to issues around the world where no one was responding to these restrictions in the political process. And then I think it accelerated, acted as an accelerant for those countries that were thinking about it and those politicians that were, because I think that they were going to do it anyway at some point. But I think the reason why California accelerated is they don't want a trucker convoy in Sacramento. And so all of a sudden they announced, yeah, we're going to get rid of these masks. Because, I mean, the Super Bowl right now, you have to be masked inside. Now, of course, you know, Gavin Newsom shows up with Magic Johnson. You think Gavin Newsom's going to mask up? No. The playoff game last week. Same with Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson, even though he's immunocompromised, he's not wearing no mask. So we'll see how many people actually wear it, because people are coming around from around the country to that game. And I think they'll get a lot of blowback from people like, what? This is insanity. Well, you know, what are you doing in California? But I think there's been so much pushback. The mask mandates are going to be gone. And I think that will even be in hardcore, like in Illinois, they lost a big suit. A court ruled that their mask mandate for school children and their testing mandate for parents and school children violated Illinois law and probably violated Illinois constitutional principles, which reflect and represent U.S. principles. So, you know, when you're seeing Illinois courts start to push back, you're going to see ultimately all of these politicians back off. And the only question is, when does, like, I think a lot of employers, if they start losing any of these cases in court, they're going to retract. I mean, I've found most employers that I've pushed back on, or people that took a lot of the free advice I put out there pushed back on, probably 80% of employers walked it back. Only about a hardcore 20%, Tyson Foods, some people like that really doubled down and tripled down. And I think when they spend millions in litigation and may end up losing across the board, having to pay back pay, double damages, other side's attorney fees, they're all going to regret that they even went down this path to begin with. So, but I think the politicians are going to be the first, and they know they got to walk it back now, because they have to have some momentum 6 months from now. And that's going to be, because otherwise, if I were betting right now, I would bet the Republicans would have a 30 to 40 seat edge in the House after 2022, have a 4 to 5 seat pickup in the Senate, and they would pick up all the big governorships and all the close states. And they would also dominate the state legislatures. And why that's big is the rules for the 2024 election are going to be determined by who gets elected in those states in 2022. And if Democrats don't control the state chambers in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, and don't have those kind of pro-democratic politicians at the Secretary of State level in Arizona and Georgia, they don't get those rules they passed in 2020. And all of a sudden the rules are different, and you know, you can't do mass mail-in balloting as easy. You don't have drop boxes. You don't have ballot harvesting. You don't have any of those things. And they know if they hadn't had those in 2020, then the outcome would have been President Trump. Basically, 2022 right now, the way it's going, guarantees a President Trump in 2024 or a President DeSantis in 2024.
Wow. I want to get your thoughts on that in just a moment. But one, two things, specific things I want you to address. You probably just discussed it when you said that you think that all mandates are going to be gone. But does that include the passports, the medicine passports for New York and San Francisco and wherever else that we're seeing them in the United States? And what do you think about airports and planes as far as the mask mandates?
I think airports and planes will probably be the last to go, because that is technically federally controlled by the Biden administration. And it's only because of a loophole. The airport planes are required to honor the a version of the Americans with Disabilities Act, just under a different law. However, you're not allowed to sue. Only the Department of Transportation can bring a legal action. And that's Buttigieg. And you know, he's not going to bring a legal action for discriminating against people based on mask wearing. So legally, they have the least exposure, and the federal government controls whether how long that mandate lasts. And for those two reasons, I suspect it will last. The irony will be it will be the last to go, probably, will be the airline mask mandate. Now, I think what you pointed out practically is the more civil disobedience rises on these planes, the more it's going to functionally disappear. Because how often are the airplanes really going to interrupt their route to stop at some random location to kick somebody off or not? If it's half the plane, it ain't happening.
Right.
So the more people civilly disobey, the more the it will die of its own accord. The other thing is, like, the vaccine mandate in the pilot context has, as people can look up separately, won't go into detail on YouTube, but it's caused particular problems, health problems for pilots in the military and outside of it. If those problems continue to accelerate, you're going to see airlines really step back and second guess the decision they made, some of them made, to mandate the vaccine.
One last thing too that just came to mind. What do you think, since it is, I assume, a federal law, what do you think about the requirement for foreigners who are coming into the United States to also have the medicine? And one of the main reasons I ask that is because I think a lot of other countries kind of take their cues from the United States. As an example, here in Colombia, you know, where I am now, they have a mandate to get into the country if you're a foreigner. So since I actually had my investment or my investor visa here, I was able to come in without the medicine because they treat me as a citizen. But I noticed that Colombia did that, I think, just right after the United States implemented that law. So do you think the United States is going to get rid of that as well? And therefore, what do you think the other countries will do? Do you think they'll follow suit?
I think those kind of restrictions will be the last to go because they're federal regulatory restrictions.
Even after the planes and masks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because or I would say parallel there too, because of I think civil disobedience might accelerate the mask mandate effectively falling before the latter does.
Yeah.
And it's because there's so much constitutional leeway as we treat people that do not have a legal right of entry. So right now, if you have a green card, they don't require it. But basically anybody doesn't have a legal right of some form of residency.
Yeah, that's what Colombia is too.
Yes, and that's what's happening. And probably for the same legal reasons, because a lot of these nations have parallel provisions at some level legally. Or in some cases, I think you're right, they're just borrowing the same language, not realizing the U.S., you know, Biden administration would have done it for everybody if they thought they could get away with it. They didn't think they could condition it right. There's a constitutional right to both interstate and international travel. The latter is sometimes disputed in the courts in the U.S., but the better argument is that there is one. There's a case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court on whether or not they can strip you of your passport based on an old tax debt. A lot of Americans don't even realize that exists, but they just do it right out of the blue. And it's like, well, you really have a constitutional right of international travel. And this is even in cases where the person may not owe the tax. The IRS says they do, but they haven't gone through the process yet to figure out whether that's accurate or not. And so in a lot of those cases are an analog cases for this context. So I think it'll probably be the last to go, but I think they wanted some of these things to be permanent. I think the goal was to condition people to accept it. And going back to your first question about civil disobedience, you look at the Patriot Act, everybody complied. 98-99% of people complied. Complied with the restrictions at the airport, complied with the surveillance that was going on. They didn't meaningfully push back or fight back. That's what they thought would happen here, because the history of government-mandated medicines is they've got away with it all the way back for a century. Going back, you talk about, you know, the quarantine camps, people talk about the Second Amendment. Well, really, the difference was civil disobedience. Here in the United States, we had mass detention camps for Japanese people during World War II. I mean, we took away everything that they had. We separated them from their families, their churches, their schools, their neighborhoods, their businesses, took their property, took their businesses, all of it. But what it was is very few of the Japanese pushed back at all. in America. So it's civil disobedience that is the real impactful aspect that separates these states' abilities to keep control and lose control. And I think that while they wanted a lot of these things to be permanent, I think they were moving in a direction of digital currencies and sticking a little chip in you. You can just study what Bill Gates does. That's going to have your health records and medical. And the way you would get the vaccine passport, it would be on your chip. That would have your medical identification card. I think all of that, they're realizing there's no way they're going to get that done at this point. And Democrats and other aligned political parties are realizing they're paying too big a price for this sort of Bill Gates vision of the world. So I think most of these things will fall, but some will be take longer than others. Ultimately, the vaccine mandate, even for entry into the country, I think will be gone within a year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense. That helps connect a lot of the dots in my mind as well. So let's move to 2024. Just for my viewers and listeners who don't know, Robert, like I said earlier, is a betting man, and he actually bets on the presidential election occasionally. And so he follows this stuff very, very, very well. So give me your thoughts. You talked about DeSantis or Trump for 2024. It sounds like you think they're going to have a foundation in which it'll be very easy. Maybe easy is not the right word, but highly probable for them to succeed. Do you think it's going to be Trump as the president, DeSantis VP, or how do you see that playing out?
I don't see any greater than I would only give Biden a 10% chance of reelection, if that. I think he has the lowest probabilities of reelection of any president in the modern age.
Okay.
I don't see, there's talk that, you know, I think the system sometimes would like to replace Biden. The problem is Harris was such a bad choice, and now everybody knows it was a bad choice inside the system, that I don't think they'll ever go that route. There's always rumors if they want to take out Biden, they'll take out Harris first. So it's like Nixon should have realized he was in trouble when they took out Agnew, because Agnew was his insurance. Nobody was going to take out Nixon and make Spiro Agnew president of the United States. But if it's Gerald Ford or Nelson Rockefeller, no problem. And so, like, I think you'll see these flare-ups with the criminal investigation of Biden's family. As a reminder, by the administrative state or deep state or whatever language people want to use of the system to keep Biden in line and potentially remove him. And the compromise would be maybe you say it's for health, you step down. And what the real leverage is we'll drop the criminal investigation if you step down. He's going to face all kinds of impeachment investigations as soon as that Republicans sweep the House and the Senate. So that's good. The Democrats set the pattern going after Trump. They're going to return the favor with Biden, and he's got real scandals all over the place. So there's whether Biden even lasts to 2024, open question. Kamala Harris is so hated. They ever put her there. That's an even worse situation for them. No matter how low Biden goes, Harris manages to stay beneath them. So at this point, I think it's whoever the Republicans nominate has a 80 to 90% chance of winning. Right now, that's overwhelmingly Trump. Trump has been in and out of touch with his own base. So for a while, he was preaching how wonderful these vaccines were and that nobody
should ask you about that.
Yeah. And some of us had been screaming at him for a year, all the way back. I mean, he retweeted me when I said, as long as Trump doesn't lock down the country, I'll build a statue to him in my front yard. And he retweeted, he said, Robert, no problems. Don't worry. A week later, he folded on those issues because they came to him and said, 2 million people are going to die. A bunch of old people are going to die. But instead, you could be the hero who saves them all, who stops the second coming of the Spanish. And he bought it all. I mean, they played to his ego very effectively. But it was his worst move as a president. Killed, sunk his economy. Ultimately led to the rule changes that allowed the election to go the way it went. He kind of realizes that now, but only kind of. He's still ego attached to the vaccines because of Operation Warp Speed. And it's like the problems are going to accumulate and the solutions are going to diminish in terms of the perceptions of this. So you should be nowhere near it. But in his last two speeches, doesn't say a word about the vaccines, starts coming out more aggressively against the mandates, says we don't need to be mandated. We don't need people to control us, govern us, dictate to us. So the more he gets connected to his base, he's still the best marketer probably in the history of modern politics. Not always the best policy guy, either coming up with policy or implementing it. But marketing-wise, it's hard to beat Trump. But if he were to falter for any reason, health, other reasons, then DeSantis would be the nominee. DeSantis has positioned himself where he will either be vice president or president in 2024.
You think that's what he wants?
Yes. Oh, yes. There's people close to him that have been building for him to run for president for 4 years.
Okay. And so what do you see? Let's just, would you assume the likelihood of one or the other being elected would be greater? And I guess I didn't phrase that very well. If Trump runs,
DeSantis is a better candidate than Trump. Trump will always have unique back. Trump is uniquely entertaining and enthusiastic with his base.
Uniquely entertaining.
Absolutely. But the flip side is he has a degree of animosity that he will in the electorate that he won't be able to overcome. Yeah. Whereas DeSantis is hard to hate. He's not as easy to love as Trump's base loves him, but he's nowhere near as easy to hate as Trump is. And so DeSantis would be the better candidate. DeSantis is also proven to be better implementing policy than Trump ever was. But I think unless Trump volunteers to step back, which is very unlikely, this is you could call it the revenge tour. I mean, the irony is if they hadn't have stolen it from, in his mind, stolen it from him, he was going to retire. I remember talking to him on the phone during the election challenges. He was ready to step back. But if he felt they screwed him, he was guaranteed to run or do everything possible to return the favor. So that's what's really motivating him right now. I don't think that's the best of motivations, but to be president, but it is, Trump's Trump. So right now, 2-1, I would make it Trump a 2-1 favorite to be the president in 2025. But DeSantis would be a third chance beneath that. So he would be he's a 2-1 underdog to be president in 2025.
But if DeSantis runs, and if he is the nominee, then you think that he will win by even a larger percentage than Trump would.
Yes. I mean, what terrified Democrats was watching Virginia and New Jersey, particularly New Jersey. It was one thing to lose Virginia's governorship. It was another thing that, a state that was supposed to be plus 15 Democrat that had a Republican that nobody knew about that spent very little money almost get the governorship of New Jersey. That's why even the governor of New Jersey, who's loved all the lockdowns and the rest, is starting to reverse all his policies this month. It's like, well, maybe it's time to step back from all this. They saw that. They're like, oh, Lord. So that's what it would look like if DeSantis was running. You would see states like New Jersey be competitive. And that's how bad a position. They're in 1984 kind of territory. Not the Orwellian version, but the Reagan-Mondale version.
Got it. All right, Robert. Incredible interview, buddy. That's an awesome conversation. I'm really going to have to think that through. Everything that you said, because, how the system really works and kind of the motivation behind the media, the politicians, the global elite, how the global elite are trying to influence the politicians, but at a certain point, the politicians are going to do what's in their best interest, and that may mean even pushing back on some of the global elite, and the global elite try to get them out of office and get someone in that will continue their narrative. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, so... Again, thank you very much. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Best place is vivabarneslaw.locals.com. And that's where I put up all the like exemplars of employee letters that people can use, no copyright asserted, copies of cases. A lot of the scientific and medical information that we can't get into in YouTube, I will post there on the locals board. That's where Viva's updates are about everything that's happening with the trucker convoy and in Canada. So everybody can go there, vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
Awesome, buddy. I appreciate it. Can't wait to do it again.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel. Yeah.